Hey, Adam Finnegan, and welcome to the Tech Bootcamp podcast.
Hello, and thank you for having me on.
Well, we're really blessed to have you, and an even greater blessing is our good friend Amy Rogel is back at Tech Bootcamp. Amy hasn't been with us since, Amy, you were what, episode 30-something, right?
53.
All right, 53. So it's been a long, long time since our friend Amy has joined us, and it is really exciting to have Amy back. So Amy, thank you for coming back and joining me as a guest co-host.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
So Adam, I know folks in the community are generally aware of you because you released the groundbreaking book, The Sleeper Agent. So just generally give us, and we're going to go into detail on the book, but generally tell us about the book and when it was released.
So my book, The Sleeper Agent, it was released December 13th on Amazon in 2023. And this book is all about the stealth biological warfare that has been going on for the last, I don't know, century or so. But it specifically hits upon Lyme disease and the work of Dr. Eric Traub. And in this book, this is the first book that is able to offer reliable evidence that Lyme disease and its co-infections are biological weapons and ties directly to Eric Traub. And we also have in this book the reasons why people can look normal but be so sick, go into the doctors, try to get help, and be turned away and told they're not sick. This is the first book that shows through Eric Traub's work how this happens. And I use quotes from his actual research that shows people having, or not people, but it shows mice with active infections, festering, you know, viral infections, yet no symptoms, no inflammation, no antibodies. And that is very significant.
Okay, Adam, so let's foreshadow a little bit more for the folks. Because your work shows more than just why someone can look good, which is one of the triggers in this community, despite feeling miserably and being chronically ill.
Yep.
But your book also does explain, and I'm going to ask you not to share exactly why now, but your book does explain why Lyme disease testing does not work. Mm-hmm. Your book does describe why the number one symptom that everyone has in common, fatigue, is not only a part of this experience or this journey, but it's actually a design element of this journey, right? So from the standpoint of gaining some validation where folks in our community are consistently gaslit by doctors, by family members, by employers, by friends, it's because of all of these design elements of this disease that you've been able to uncover and connect to the work to at least one bio terrorist.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. And it will do a lot for the people that have a lot of questions and, you know, being gaslit, as you said, because it's happened to me. And it's a very disheartening, miserable experience to go through, but this offers the answers as to why this is happening.
Let me just ask you to comment on one more thing. It is literally a design element of this bioweapon, correct?
Yeah, that was kind of the blueprint for all of his stealth biological weapons. Now, typical everybody's like typical idea of a bioweapon is something that kills a lot of people and, you know, quickly. This is the complete opposite. This is what is called a strategic biological weapon, where it's not looking to cause mass fatalities. It's meant to proliferate a population entire and exhaust, but be stealth. So it's kind of hidden and tire and exhaust and overwhelm.
Okay, so let's move forward a little bit. And we're going to talk about the difference between tactical bioweapons and strategic bioweapons later on in the podcast. Let's talk about Adam. So who is Adam? Where did you grow up and what was your early life like?
I grew up in Grafton, Massachusetts, which is central Massachusetts near Worcester, Massachusetts. And I grew up in the suburbs. I had a good upbringing. I had good parents. My mother later found out she had Lyme disease in, I think it was like 1999 or 2000 or so. But she may have had it all along. I grew up, however, I had a brother and he was kind of problematic, I'll say. And overall, I had a good upbringing, but I started to have problems in like high school. I believe it may have been due to adverse effects of a Hep B vaccine, which I later found out caused all of the problems I was experiencing. Me and my brother both were kind of out of control, starting to drink and party and everything. I ended up getting kicked out of two high schools. My brother got in a lot of trouble too. And so I, and then I started to kind of go off the deep end. I got really into like drugs and trouble, being like a troublemaker and drugs and all of that stuff. And you know, I just remember always kind of feeling lousy, just feeling like crap. And I think that's, but never being able to really put my finger on why.
So Adam, let's build this out a little bit. So just, we have an international community of folks who listen to this podcast. So you grew up in Massachusetts, which is just north of Connecticut, right? So everybody on our podcast is aware of Lyme, Connecticut. But you grew up in what we call the Lyme Belt, which is on the east coast of the US. And you grew up just north of Connecticut. So talk to us about what you knew about ticks and tick diseases during your childhood. Meaning, you did tease us a little bit and you said you think your mom had Lyme. You may have had congenital Lyme disease. So I'm just wondering what your experience was with during your childhood with ticks and tick diseases. And were you given any information or training either in school or through social channels, through parenting, about how to avoid coming in contact with ticks, and how to protect yourself if you did come in contact with ticks.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was. I remember specifically, though, that there was one woman on our street that had Lyme, and everybody's saying, oh, this woman has Lyme disease. And I didn't really know what it was. And, you know, my parents didn't talk much about it. And we were never really told, you know, these ticks are carrying all these diseases and stuff. I just completely unaware. And but I don't remember having a big tick problem back then. Like I growing up, I don't really remember having this nasty tick problem. I mean, I can't even remember a time when I pulled a tick off me growing up.
Well,
I mean, I'm sh sure
and you
I
know,
did,
Adam,
but
well, you know, Adam, and that's not all that uncommon, right? 80% of the people who are chronically ill from Lyme disease do not remember a tick bite, right? Because they are stealth agents, right? And I know you're going to talk to us more about why ticks are very powerful vectors for the transmission of these bioweapons. But it is intentional, right? It, again, we're talking about design aspects of this bioweapon, right? And you know, there are a lot of different elements to tactical bioweapons. And part of part of this, of course, is that when you're using a tool like this, I'm sorry, for a strategic bioweapon, you want deniability, right? And deniability is something that's pretty common, I think, for two different reasons. Reason one is that ticks are hard to find, and 80% of the people who have Lyme disease did not ever discover a tick. But two, there's generally some gap in time between a tick bite and ultimately the onset of chronic illness. So that gives additional bioweapon to folks who are using this strategic bioweapon, right? So Let's fast forward. So talk about, what your vision was for your future. You did not feel well. You were masking how you were feeling by using drugs and other intoxicants to to mask how you were feeling. Where were you where were you heading? What was your vision for how you were going to serve the world during these early days of your life?
Well, I was a drummer in a lot of like hardcore heavy metal bands, and that was kind of like my plan was that I wanted to be a drummer. I did play a lot of shows and had a great time, but it was eventually the band broke up, and then I started to party a lot more and use drugs more often, and then. And things just went really downhill. Probably from the time, let's see, I think 18, 19 started to get really bad. And then by like all the way up to like 25, 26, well, actually, all the way up to the time I was 30. And I actually didn't think I was going to make it past 30.
So Adam, talk to us about your health, right? I mean, you are talking about what you were using to mask the pain that you were in as a result of the physical, neurological, and psychological elements of your illness that had not yet been diagnosed. But you haven't told us a lot about what was going on with your health and how you were first feeling physically, neurologically, and emotionally. What was going on in that window of time before your diagnosis?
Yeah, it was a lot of I felt fatigued a lot. That was one thing I do remember. And I had, on and off like symptoms, certain like joint pain, problems that would come back every now and then, certain things. But overall, I wasn't really aware that I was even sick. But I was having a lot of mental problems, and that was one of the things that I will later hit upon. And that's all I really remember.
So Adam,
Because
talk to us about your mental health issues, because this is an important element of this, and talk to us a little bit about the nootropic elements of the design of bioweapons.
Yeah, so I had a lot of mental health problems during that time. Frustration, easily frustrated. I grew up kind of like a very different person. I never felt like I belonged in the world. I always felt somebody that did not really belong into the world, even though I had like friends and everything, and I was good at socializing. But I just kind of felt a different person. Like, it's just very unique. And I am kind of an introvert, so it was like that. And I just saw like this 9 to 5 working job, all the way that society is structured. It just seems so absurd to me. And I was kind of just like, I don't want to do this. And I had trouble. And so going through like psychiatry and all that was really not at all helpful. Oh, and they also put me on a really addictive medication called Klonopin, which I was on for 14 years. And that really kind of made it very hard. It really kind of like numbed me out to such a degree that I really couldn't tune into me as a person. So those years all the way up to 30 were very blurry, just kind of like a train with no brakes eventually. And then I kind of got better. I mean, at 30, decided that I was going to get better.
Okay, let's pause there for a second. How many different psychologists, psychiatrists, and medical doctors did you see between the time that you had the onset of your psychological symptoms and the time that you were finally diagnosed with Lyme disease?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, it was a lot. I went to a lot of them and just, they gave me all this medication, but it really didn't help overall. And I'm pretty sure like a lot of those problems started after some of these vaccines that they gave me, like the Hep B vaccine. It's just some of those adverse effects of the neurotropic effects of those antigens. And I started to have those same symptoms that were being reported in the congressional hearing on that vaccine in 1999. So I also think I probably had a subclinical or hidden infection of Lyme disease.
Okay, so let me build out this piece a little bit more. So you're growing up in the Lyme Belt. You are seeing many medical professionals. Did anyone before putting you on, for example, this very addictive drug, Klonopin, did anyone either before you were put on that drug or during any of the time that you were taking that drug, the 14 years, ever suggest to you that you should be tested for Lyme disease?
Not one.
So talk to us about your diagnosis. When did you get diagnosed with Lyme disease?
So it was 2016 that I got a tick bite, but I was like, okay, it's a tick, and I didn't save it. I didn't even look for a bullseye rash. But I do remember not long after that having these symptoms start, just these crazy headaches and the whole like front of my face going numb, numb and tingly, and all around my head was the same feeling, joint pain, chronic fatigue. Some days the fatigue was just so crippling. And I would get nauseous. I remember vomiting actually through that initial illness, and I had like vertigo, whereas almost vertigo. I was so dizzy, and I'd lay down and it felt like the room was spinning. And eventually I'm like, okay, I'm gonna go to the doctor, and they'll be able to figure out what's wrong with me, and then I'll go on with my life. That so I went in, and what he said was, you have viral labyrinthitis that's going around. Okay, but he's like, you'll be better in a few weeks. Like, okay. I never got better. That never happened. And so I kept going in. I went to my primary care doctors to send me to a neurologist to send me to the ear, nose, and throat. None of them had any idea what was going on. And I had like this intense pressure in my sinus area and in my head. And they just had absolutely no answers. And they would send me to someone else and send me to someone else. And it was just, it was getting me nowhere. So eventually I started, back when I was in social media, I started to talk to other people, and I got involved with the, because I had suspected Lyme disease because my mother had Lyme disease.
Okay, well, let's stop there before you go on the story. So, what was it about your experience that caused you to suspect Lyme disease? And how long after the tick bite did you begin to suspect it was Lyme disease and perhaps connected to that tick bite?
Yeah, I think it was just I was doing my own research on like the symptoms that I was having, and looking into forums where other people were talking. And I can't remember where it was where I kind of focused in on Lyme disease, but eventually I did, and based on conversations with my mother, because she had Lyme disease too. And so I started to suspect that. And then eventually I got involved with groups that were kind of like Lyme activists. And she kind of told me what tests to get and where to go. I ended up getting a Lyme doctor for a short time. It was in Newton, somewhere in Newton, and I got the test, based on what my friend said, make sure you get this test. I think it was the IGX or something.
Hygienics, yes, I do.
Yes. And
Yep.
so they
So
tested me.
Adam, before you talk about the hygienics test, because Amy's going to take you through that. I want to talk to you a little bit more about your mom and her Lyme disease journey, and then Amy's going to take you through the testing.
Yeah.
How long before you were diagnosed with Lyme disease, was your mother diagnosed with Lyme disease?
So I was diagnosed in 20, I think it was 2017 or 2018, maybe, but my mother had Lyme disease. I think maybe it was like 2002 or something. And she was really sick all the way up to like 2010 or so, or 2009. And she went to some of the well-known Lyme doctors like Sam Donta, and I can't remember who else, but she treated heavily with antibiotics. She seemed to get better for a while, although she's sick now with it. So it didn't really, went, it seemed to go into remission for a while, but she's got it, like it's back into active form now today. So yeah, that's kind of, and she had gotten that Lymerix vaccine too before she got sick in 1999, but she still got Lyme disease. So that's kind of her background with it.
Okay, so you observed all of these things in your mom. So you were generally aware of what the symptom presentation was. You were now dealing with these symptoms. You start interacting with folks in Lyme forms, and now you go to a doctor who's going to test you for Lyme disease. So Amy's now going to talk to you about the different tests you've taken, and maybe you can share with our listeners while Amy's taking you through that. What kinds of challenges you saw with your testing, and how that maybe became a clue to some of the research you were taking. Amy, you ready?
Sure. So, Adam, diagnostics, do you remember exactly what tests you did use?
I do not. However, I do remember, getting the regular CDC tests that they give in like the regular doctors, and they told me that I didn't have it. And my friend Jenna said, "Oh, make sure you get the test results and look at it." And so I got the test results. She's like, "Oh, you have band 41, that's spirochetes." And then I had some of the outer surface proteins, like outer surface protein A, a number of different bands for those outer surface proteins. But she's like, "You have spirochetes." And so I went to the doctor. A Lyme doctor, and I think it was that IGX test, and they tested me. It didn't come back for co-infections, but I had one. I had Borrelia burgdorferi, and I had Mycoplasma pneumoniae, and reactivated Epstein-Barr virus, human herpes virus 6, which is that common encephalitis virus.
Oh, I'm so amazed by people that can get positive Lyme blood tests. I tried, I couldn't, and everyone wrote me off.
Yeah.
But did you get any misdiagnoses?
Oh yeah. Of course, like when I went in initially, they told me viral labyrinthitis is going around, you'll be better soon.
Right.
And then I can't remember if they gave me any other diagnoses like yeah, no, I don't think they did. I think they just didn't have any answers.
Do you remember like what your first course of treatment was?
I think I was trying to treat it on my own using various things, supplements, alternative treatments. Like I just didn't get better. And sometimes I think treating it so hard, trying to treat it so hard, I think I made myself even sicker sometimes. Kind of experimenting with different things.
Yeah, I agree. I think I tend to think sometimes Lyme disease treatment is just individualized to each person. What
Yeah.
works for some people isn't going to work for other people.
Yeah.
So, did you find that when you're going through your treatment, when you hit those little bricks where you're like, okay, this isn't working, or oh, this is working, did you experience any discouragement?
Of course, a lot of discouragement. It was like, no matter how hard I tried, I could not put a dent in these headaches that I had. And I still have the headaches today. They're constant, they never go away, but you kind of learn how to deal with them. But back then, I did deal with a lot of discouragement. There were days where I just felt so sick and looking like, oh, this is the future. This is my future. Waking up every day feeling like I've been poisoned. And kind of clinging on to consciousness some days where you're in so much agony. So that I went
Yeah.
through, yeah, for a number of years my life was like that.
Yeah, I remember a lot of the pain. So when you experienced a lot of that discouragement and stuff, did you have any support from your, aside from the Lyme groups you hung out with, did you get any support system from family or friends or?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because my mother had Lyme disease, they already knew. So I did. I had friends, I had family, and also a lot of good people in the Lyme activism and Lyme groups and such that understood and kind of suffered along with them,
I understand. So in general, aside from the headaches and some lingering symptoms, how do you feel today, like health-wise? Are you doing?
Yeah, today I'm doing well. Like, I mean, I've still got health problems, but I'm doing a lot better. I think I can't really pinpoint exactly which aspect of it, but I think overall, I mean, based on my conversations with a lot of the Lyme activists, a lot of people will get sick, really sick for a number of years. And then slowly start to bounce back. People end up kind of like coming out of that really terrible period. And it happens to some people who don't even treat at all. So it's hard to say, but I kind of see, I saw a lot of people who are just spending, massive amounts of money to some of these doctors and not getting any better. And it was just like draining their bank account, but yet they're not getting any better. And I kind of felt like I didn't want to take that route. I just kind of felt like even when I was with that Lyme doctor, I just kind of felt, and I had been doing all of the research for this book and studying the work of Traub and his how this whole, immune tolerance phenomenon, which I will describe later, works. And I just kind of felt like the doctor was just kind of like grasping in the dark, didn't really know what he was doing. And I just kind of felt like I don't want to have a lot of money being spent on this where it doesn't feel like this person really knows what he's doing, just kind of experimenting with different things. And I know a lot of people who said they got sicker from the antibiotics. So I kind of went a different route.
And I know you mentioned diet was a big factor in your treatment. I have a bachelor's in nutritional sciences, so my kind of geekiness is around the nutrition and Lyme disease. What did you notice any particular foods that would cause more inflammation? Did you start by eliminating things that would cause? What did you do for your diet?
I think, well, I started to read about diet, And I started to read. There was a book by R. Swinburne Climber called Diet, the Way to Health. And I started to read that. And it was interesting because he was talking about even if you overeat good food, it can still be harmful to you. Like the amount you eat is also important. And combining certain foods is not good, and things like that. And I just eliminating a lot of, there's so much stuff that has all sorts of these additives and preservatives that are very, dubious as far as safety. And so, you wonder how much that plays into it, but or how much that agitates the disease. So I started to get really like health conscious about what I buy, looking at the ingredients. I try to eat all the organic foods, lots of vegetables, fruits, to kind of phase out the starches and of course sugar. And I just another big thing is exercise for me. Like I like to ride BMX biking. So it's kind of, it was like the thing in the 80s, back in the 80s and 90s. A lot of people like BMX biking, and like I go to the skate park sometimes too, and so I really like doing that. And I really love heavy metal music. So when I ride, I listen to my heavy metal music, and it's like a really good time. And I would say also a big thing for me is the spiritual aspects, and that probably more than anything else has been one of those things. And my spirituality is kind of integrated into this reality. It's not like this place that's far off. It's also about practical things in this reality too. So I don't know. I mean, that's been kind of like my approach. I didn't try to treat it heavily. And also some of the supplements are also, it seems there's a lot about the supplements that can kind of also aggravate health. Like so there's a lot of, fillers and things of that nature that come along with some of the supplements they sell on Amazon. And a lot of people might feel worse from some of them. So I didn't really go that route either. I just kind of stuck with diet, exercise, and of course my spirituality. And I read daily, so I like to read about things of that nature, the spiritual sciences and whatnot.
I found actually tried to set out to determine like what would be the best thing that limeys could eat nutrition wise, and even with talking with my holistic, we just came to the conclusion that I mean it's going to depend on what strain of lime someone has, what co-infections they have. For me, I remember I couldn't eat any fresh produce; it just ripped up my stomach. I would get digestive paralysis.
Yeah.
And then
Oh,
the lime diet is all about fresh foods. And I was like, yeah, I can't even.
that's another thing is that I gave up meat. I'm a vegetarian. That's another thing that I do with diet. I don't eat meat. And especially after, if somebody reads my book, you'll see how meat has always been a target for things of like bioterrorism and such, and because humans are going to eat it, so I gave up meat.
Yeah. Do you so yeah, you're completely, did you say vegetarian or vegan?
I'm vegetarian.
Okay. So do you, I found that dairy was super inflammatory. Did you ever have any issues with that?
I don't take in a whole lot of dairy. Like I kind of teeter on the vegan side, but I'm not, I'm not, I don't call myself that because I don't completely adhere to it yet. I mean, I may do that and I'm thinking about it, but I'm like kind of take one step at a time. First, I'll be a vegetarian, you know what I mean? And that's going great. And I may at some point take the vegan route, but not there yet.
Yeah, I always say that life is really short and you got to find what works for you, especially with your nutrition.
I feel like it's definitely an individual thing. Like I just kind of I like I said, I see a lot of people draining. I've heard stories of people who spent just a ridiculous amount of money paying people to get better and are in no better a position than someone like me who hasn't spent a dime, in the last however many years on a Lyme doctor or anything. And I'm not trying to dissuade people. I'm just saying that, I do feel like it's an individual thing. Each person has to decide for themselves, what route should I go? Take some time to research and ask around, get to know what other people have done, and that's kind of like how you navigate.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. Gosh, what other questions could I possibly think of?
So, I mean, why don't we take Adam together through now, his research and how this became a way of redefining himself, right? So Adam, you shared with us during your early life that you were a musician. You were struggling with mental health issues during the mid part of your life, and you were kind of trying to find a purpose, right? You were trying to find yourself. You knew it wasn't in the 9 to 5 world the way you described that before, but you still hadn't been able to find your purpose. But in this Lyme journey, you did find your purpose. So talk to us about how Lyme disease was instructive to you spiritually in discovering what God created you to do.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I never planned to do this kind of work. I never planned to go deep into immunology and get really to get such a vast expertise on such a topic. However, I can say that I was always interested in the subject. Like, if I walk into a library, that was the first thing I wanted to read about. I was like, let's go see if there's books on biological warfare. And I don't ask me why, but I like, things like The Hot Zone about Ebola. That really just kind of stirred my interest in anything about biological warfare. So I found Lab 257 one time at a time when I was doing really bad too, and I had to go to the library. And I went to a library. I got that book. I read that book, and this character Trav always stuck into the back of my mind. Like, he's a very mysterious person, and I don't know why I feel a pull to looking into this, but I had forgotten about it for a while. My mom got Lyme disease. I eventually got that book again and gave it to her. And then fast forward, when I got sick and when I found out it was Lyme disease, I started looking into all of this, and I remember John Loftus, the one he wrote the introduction to this book. I remember reading about his claims in Lab 257 because he was also Michael Christopher Carroll's source. He had brought out that Lyme disease was the result of biological warfare experiments on Plum Island.
So Adam,
And
let's build out, because there are a lot of characters in your journey and in your book. So let's talk about Mr. Loftus first, because he did write a very powerful introduction to your book. So he's a former federal prosecutor. He had one of the highest levels of security clearance. He's an author. He was profiled on 60 Minutes in a double episode, which had won an Emmy Award. Just one of the most credible Americans in this space. And he actually wrote the introduction to your book, where He praised you in so many very powerful ways, including suggesting that you may be the first non-doctor to be awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. And he said, based on his experience as an attorney in the federal prosecutor's office with level Q security clearance, that he was able to verify over 70% of what you had argued in your book. So talk to us about Mr. Loftus, and now that I've given a context to our folks, and how important he was in your journey.
Yeah, so when I started looking into this, and I felt really motivated, just driven, almost like it was a force outside of myself moving through me, which I would call the divine. I reached out to John Loftus. I had put like this timeline together of all these biological warfare events and stuff, and I had sent it to him. I got his contact information somehow and sent it to him. And I didn't hear back from him for a while. And then one day he saw it and he replied and said he thought it was brilliant work. And, here's my number. Why don't you give me a call? So I gave him a call. We talked for a while. He was a very nice, very just an awesome person to know. And he said, because I wanted to know more about his revelations and Eric Traub and he said, "Oh, I've got some filmmakers, two girls that have been asking me also, and they're writing a screenplay. And why don't I introduce you to them?" And so John Loftus introduced me to those two girls, Jody Savin and Crystal Bennett, and we had like this little group, and we're always communicating via email. They were like, "We'll help you get, some documents or whatever. You do all your research and you let us know what you find and what kind of work as a group here. You write your book, we write our screenplay, and you can kind of advise us because based on this book, they're writing the screenplay with kind of like overlapping material that's going to be about the same stuff as this book." And so we did that, and John Loftus also had some biodefense sources that were kind of telling him some things that had come to him, as a, because he was kind of like acting as a pro bono attorney for people with security clearances that wanted to tell him things that were going on that shouldn't be going on. And he would do that. And so he was able to give me a lot of leads as to things and events to look into throughout my journey. And I did that. And he kind of, I was able to really, verify a lot of what he had said originally, in his revelation in 1982 about Plum Island and things of that nature. So he had said he, when he made that revelation about ticks spreading Lyme disease as a result of biological warfare activities, he had said that Lyme disease was being spread by ticks a year before they had even acknowledged that it was being spread by ticks.
All right, so Adam, let's pause there for a second because I think that's one of the controversial areas in this community, right? When we have conversations with folks about Lyme disease as a bioweapon, what many people point to is that Lyme disease has been a part of the human experience for as long as there have been humans. For example, in Dr. Bill Rawls's book, Unlocking Lyme, he argues that ticks have been biting people as long as there are people. So if that's the case, that ticks have been biting people for as long as there have been people, and that Lyme has always been a part of our journey, what's different now? Because I don't think you would argue that Lyme disease was created in a laboratory at Plum Island or anywhere else. It is a natural bacteria. But what were they doing in the bioweapons area to cause this disease to be more likely to make someone sick?
Yeah, so it was he had there was a so there was a strain of Borrelia that was from birds, Relia and Serena. And that was the spirochete that would later be enhanced using natural viruses and things of that nature, that would become different from the Borrelia and Serena, and it would be a new it had new properties and could infect humans and cause a disease. So I would say that, so he was taking these things, natural things that have been around for as long as time, and he was enhancing them with other natural things that he found, for example, LCM virus, and to make it more immunosuppressive, to cause this immune tolerance phenomenon that he had discovered. And I guess a lot of it had to do with adapting it to different animals as well, so it could be spread by many animals in an ecosystem. Does that answer your question, or?
It does. So let's build this out a little bit more, right? So let's now connect it to your journey that Amy was just going over with you, so that folks in this community can have a better understanding of what's going on with them, what's causing them to be sick, what kinds of steps they may want to take to help themselves overcome their illness, right? So are because humans have been coming in contact with Borrelia as long as there have been humans, we do have an element of our immune system that is designed to essentially be the software to deal with this bacteria, right? So in order to make us sick, what did Eric Traub is the person that you're now studying. And actually, let's go into this for a little bit. Who is Eric Traub, and how did you come across him?
Well, Eric Traub, he is a German virologist. That's what he's most well known for. Most people would find that he's a foot and mouth disease expert and worked in animal diseases as a veterinarian. And he was also heavy into the biological warfare programs of many nations. He was like the all-star bioweaponeer during that time. So from he went into veterinary medicine. Now he studied at the Rockefeller Institute before World War II. He came over from 1933 to 1938, and it was at the Rockefeller Institute that he learned about this condition called that would later be called immune tolerance. And it's synonymous with chronic immunosuppression, like a wrecked immune system. Immune system gets thrown into disarray, and this slow chronic disease follows. Now that's kind of a blueprint of Lyme disease as well. This LCM virus, even though it's a virus, it's because of the way it disables the immune system is why it's such a similar disease, because Lyme disease also disables the immune system in a similar way. Now it's these lipid-like antigens that are the cause of this. And so this is on the LCM virus, it's on the spirochete too. So these outer surface proteins, or you call it a spike protein on a virus, these are the things that throw the immune system into disarray, and this is what kind of brings out this slow chronic disease.
Okay, so let's pause there for another second to give our folks a larger context. So, prior to and during World War II, what most people are aware of was that there was a race to atomic weapons, right? The Russians had their program, the Germans had their program, the British had their program. We here in the U.S. had our program, right? And of course, we're all aware of that race to the atom bomb, because the Americans won the race and ultimately used those weapons in Japan, right? And there, recently there was an award-winning movie that just won a number of different Academy Awards even this year, right? But what most folks don't know, Adam, is that the same time that there was this international race to discover this atomic bomb, there was actually also biological weapon programs that were actually, at least in the US, two times as large as the Manhattan Project that we're all more familiar with. So why don't you talk a little bit more about where Eric Traub fits into this? Because clearly the Germans, in addition to their atomic weapons program, also had a biological weapons program. And the British had a biological weapons program, and the Russians had a biological weapons, and the United States had, and many other countries had them. And although they're not as well known, because there wasn't this seminal event of all of the death and destruction from the dropping of the bombs, they were actually larger programs. So please fit Eric Traub into this program and talk about why he was, you're seeing him as a seminal figure in this, and you argued in your book even more likely to have created this weapon than Willy Burgdorfer, who has been credited in some circles with perhaps having created this weaponized disease.
So Eric Traub. So biological warfare was a big deal, and it's not as well known because it's far more classified, and just that's why you don't hear about any of the activities. It's super classified, and people know that using nuclear weapons, it causes so much destruction. But biological warfare, especially Eric Traub's version of biological warfare, is something that's stealth. It could be, labeled as a natural event. You could attack someone and say, "Oh no, it was an act of nature." You couldn't do that with chemical or nuclear weapons. So this was a big thing in that sense. And Eric Traub developed. He was able to develop a big biological warfare program for Nazi Germany. And at the time, they had sanctions against them for using chemical and biological warfare in World War I. So what they would do is they would get very good at hiding their biological warfare programs under benign research and agricultural problems and animal disease. Because they didn't want to, it took them a long time to pay off that debt, and they didn't want to get any more sanctions. So they would hide these things under benign research. And Eric Traub was very skilled, for whatever reason, very skilled. He was like an all-star. He just had a knack for doing this stuff. And before the days of recombinant DNA technology, they would change things using animal passages. So
Okay, let's
certain.
pause. Let's pause there for a second, because this is a really important part of your book. Because I was trying to figure out, because this is pre-CRISPR, and because this is pre-discovery of even the human genome project, right? How were they making the changes that changed the virility of these bacteria, if they didn't have the same tools they have now? What did Eric Traub do?
Yeah, so he became very proficient in, so bioengineering in the days before this technology was done using selective animal passages. So running a disease agent through certain animals, in serial passages, just over and over and over.
So describe what that is. Give more detail. So they would put the germ in a mouse, for example, right? And when it was in the mouse, the strain of the bacteria would change. They would then take that strain from the mouse, and they now put it into a bird, right? And now the strain of the bacteria would change again because it was in a bird. Now, when it went from the mouse to the bird, how did that impact humans, for example?
So sometimes they would have to run it through the same animal like a lot of times to get it to mutate, but they had it down to a science, and Eric Traub even uses diagrams in a lot of his papers. They found a lot of times that chicken eggs, growing it in chicken eggs, would often adapt certain diseases to humans. We have a similar immune system to the bird for some reason. We have very We have a lot of similarity with the avian immune system. But it was also like when you ran it through mice, for example, it would raise the what are called neurotropic qualities, which meant it would take to the brain and central nervous system in a more profound way. And that
Okay,
was
well,
always the case
this
with.
is important, Adam, right? So because many, many people who have Lyme disease have neurological symptoms. You described to me and Amy during the earlier part of this podcast that your symptomology was largely neurological, right? So one of the things that Eric Traub had developed was putting this bacteria, which if we were bitten by a tick with the strains of bacteria that humans would customarily come in contact with, for the millions of years that we were coming in contact with, and the millions of years, our immune system had been defeating this or managing this bacteria. They were now changing the bacteria, right? And one of the things they were doing is they were trying to change it so that it would ultimately cause us to suffer neurological symptoms. And how they did that is they keep running it through the mouse, and as the strains were changing, that wasn't enough, right? Because what they also wanted to do is they made it so that it was more likely to be a neurological disease. But then what they wanted to do is they wanted to defeat the human immune system. So they take this now changed strain and they now put it into either birds or bird eggs, because when that now defeats the bird's immune system, it makes it more likely that it will defeat our immune system, correct?
Yeah, something like that. And also he would adapt it to many diverse animals so that it could maintain itself in an ecosystem and pretty much infect everything. And Lyme disease pretty much does that. I mean, you got the I know there were papers showing that it was in deer. Mice, squirrels, you name it. And so he would use animal diseases or animal viruses to adapt the spirochete to different things. So he'd use like foot and mouth disease to adapt it to cattle as well. It's hard. It's kind of hard to explain. It was a kind of a complicated science, but Eric Traub had it down, to a science. He was very skilled in all of this, and that's why. Being a veterinarian was such a big deal.
So, all right, so Adam, now you would expect now World War II ends. Nazis are being put on trial as war criminals. Was Eric Traub put on trial and imprisoned, or did something else happen with Eric Traub?
So his lab was captured by the Soviet Union, put under the personal protection of Joseph Stalin. They hauled all the research off to Russia, and they were interrogating them, looking for war crimes. And it seems as though they were asking, was the animal crematory used to dispose of human bodies? Now, they had forced labor at Insel-Reims, and they probably were testing, and they probably did have war crimes on Eric Traub. And it seems at that point they used that as leverage to blackmail him. So you can go to Nuremberg or you can work for us. Kind
All
of
right,
that kind of thing.
so we know that at the same time that during World War II that we had the American bioweapons program and the British bioweapons program, we had the Russian bioweapons program, and the Russians now, instead of putting Eric Traub on trial for war crimes, they actually take his treasure trove of research and they use that to enhance their own biological weapons program. Is that correct?
More specifically, is that he would become a KGB agent and work for the Soviet Union when he would be sent over for paperclip.
Okay, so now let's take the next step. So he gets rather than put on trial for war crimes, he now becomes an agent for the KGB, and they now send him where? How does he ultimately get to America, and where does he serve in America as an undercover KGB agent?
So he was able to facilitate this so-called escape from East Germany or Insel-Reims, where it was under Russian occupation. Although they knew about it the whole time. He didn't really escape. They let him go as a KGB agent. It was facilitated with one of the Cambridge Five spies, Donald MacLean. Donald MacLean was a British intelligence guy who would end up defecting to Moscow in 1951, but he was very high up. He had a lot of secrets, and he helped. But he was a double agent, and he was facilitating a lot of the Nazis that would be going over to America to work. So he helped get Eric Traub over to America, and he was Eric Traub got to America in 1949, and he went to work at Bethesda at the Naval Research. What was it? The What was it? It was in Maryland. It was for the Navy, and he was to start going to work, working in biological warfare. And he, I can show that he was also an employee at Plum Island. They were planning on putting him there the entire time, even before they had the lab, even before they had the location of where they wanted to put the lab. They had made a reference to him in a congressional hearing.
All right, so
So,
let's build this out a little bit. So Plum Island is a small island right off of Long Island where I live and grew up. I've actually seen Plum Island a number of different occasions when I was out in Greenport, and it is a controversial it's a controversial piece of land here in New York because they had been testing all types of viruses and germs, and we do know that it has a sordid history. So this Nazi bioweaponeer who gets captured by the Russians gets converted to a KGB agent, then. With the help of the British intelligence agencies, gets sent to the US.
By a double agent.
All right. So now he's in the US and he's doing research in the US and he's seeing, of course, what other types of research is being done in the US. And again, we have our own sordid history with biological weapons. Now let's sort of bring this together, right? So one of the things you had in your journey is that you went to see many, many doctors over the course of a long period of time with neurological symptoms and psychiatric symptoms. Yet no one ever asked the question, Adam, do you have Lyme disease? Talk about why the work of Eric Traub made it so that someone who has long-term chronic Lyme disease with neurological symptoms would not be thought to have Lyme disease.
The problem is, so when all of this went down, this is an area that they started to kind of cover up, and they were trying to kind of obscure all of Eric Traub's work as well, and he made very big discoveries, especially with this, I talk about it in my book a lot, immune tolerance. This
But
is
Adam, build this out for us, right? Because look,
okay.
you just now described how Traub was able to change the strain of Lyme disease so that it would be more likely to impair your neurological system. It impaired your neurological system and almost all of the neurological systems of the people who listen to this podcast, right? So you describe that for us. But now describe for us why doctors are hard to un find it hard to see that as connected to Lyme disease, because you did at the beginning of this podcast when we were doing the foreshadowing piece of this, you did talk about why this is a disease that causes you to become chronically ill, but you don't look ill. How is that a design feature of this disease based on the work of Eric Trout?
Yeah, he talked about it in some of his work with LCM, where he said eventually with this LCM virus, it is so hard to sort out the infected mice from the non-infected mice that even a connoisseur of the virus could no longer distinguish between healthy and non-healthy mice. And so he had shown all of this, but the doctors are trained kind of like in the opposite direction. They never want to look at infectious causes. It's always disorders, things that, they can put it in a box. It's a disorder you'll have to manage for the rest of your life. And there's no explanation as to why this is. It just is.
Okay, so now let's pause there. It's because now another part of your journey, and I know it was a part of Amy's journey as well, is that when you take the traditional two-tier Lyme disease test, that it's very unlikely to give you a positive result despite being infected with Lyme disease. So you've built this out that it's a neurological disease based on the changing of the strains and moving it from species to species to species, right? You've now built out that it is a disease that does not cause you to be perceived, at least outwardly, as being sick. Now the next piece of this is, well, if a doctor can't see that you're sick, now a doctor is going to rely on testing, right? On blood testing. Talk to us about how Trout designed this disease so that it would defeat the traditional two-tier test.
So what he noticed in with his agents, they were immunosuppressive. They suppressed the immune system, and like his LCM virus studies, the mice did not make many antibodies. I mean, some made, a few, but overall, no antibodies. It was suppressing the immune system. So it's kind of contrary to making antibodies. It's like putting it to sleep so that it doesn't. And so
And
with
how does it
these.
do that? You describe in your book how Trout discovered how to put your immune system, to use your words, to sleep. How does it do that?
I don't know really. All he found was that these lipid-like antigens overwhelm and exhaust the immune system, and then they stop making antibodies after this immune deficiency comes on. And it's the same deal with Lyme disease, and they kind of set it up so that you need to make a lot of antibodies in order to test positive. They said they were being more specific, but what it was doing, and they did this in 1994 at the Dearborn Conference, the second Dearborn Conference. They raised the bar, so you had to make a lot more antibodies in order to test positive when most people make a lot less. And now nobody can really make that cutoff where they raise the bar so that you have to make. The only people who have Lyme disease are the ones who make a robust immune response to it.
All right, so let's build that out, right? So the two-tier test is looking for an antibody response, but this bacteria was designed to prevent an antibody response, right? So you look good, you don't test positive for the disease, you have neurological issues, right? And then of course, what happens is this is where now we find ourselves really putting not only pressure on the people who are suffering from the disease, but we're now putting pressure on the medical system, right? Because there's now a conflict between the people who are providing the care, who don't see anything wrong with you and can't test you in a way that gives them any information about what you may be suffering from. So they start to tell you that you're not well. I mean, that you're emotionally unhealthy, which of course you are, because this disease was designed to create neurological impairment. But of course, you're not being gaslit by your doctors, and the medical system being overwhelmed. Then what's happening?
And they come up with the word somatoform and psychosomatic, but that's not what's happening here. It's they these are immunosuppressive, and they don't acknowledge this outcome as a disease. They don't acknowledge that immune tolerant state, that chronic immunodeficiency state that this produces.
So, Adam, please talk about immune tolerance a little bit more. You really did a beautiful job of describing that in the book, and I do want our listeners to understand that, because what we do know from almost all of the experts that we've interviewed on this podcast is that it's the immune system that wins the day, right? If you're going to get better the way you and Amy have, it's by making sure that you're working to improve your immune system so that your immune system can defeat these germs that are in your system. So what is immune tolerance, and why is that a bad thing?
Okay, so immune tolerance is the term. Eric Schaub did not come up with the term, but it was eventually settled, by a consensus. Eventually, in like 1960, they started to use that term immune tolerance. Now, immune tolerance means that your immune system has been suppressed to such an extent, it's being actively suppressed to such an extent that it's forced to tolerate harmful pathogens that it should otherwise be keeping out of the body.
Right, so
So it's
they're not
like,
So your immune system is not killing the germs that it's supposed to be killing in
Yeah.
your system. It's tolerating them and allowing them to attack your system.
Yeah, and so that involves also a central nervous system invasion and organ invasion. So when it's just kind of like standing idly by and letting all of these pathogens invade, now it's not choosing to do that. It's being actively suppressed by a lot of these antigens. These antigens are kind of overwhelming the immune system, confusing the immune system. You've heard the word immune exhaustion is a good word for it. Eric Schaub also talked about it as an immune paralysis. That's another term that they've come up with. Also, endotoxin tolerance has been a term for it. Now, long COVID is another term for this immune tolerance. That's what long COVID is. It's an immune tolerance. Eric Schaub discovered this with LCM virus in 1936.
And
And
that's a feature that he brought now to
yeah.
bioengineered Lyme disease. Now let's talk about two other pieces of this in the Lyme journey, right? Because one of the things that we see in the Lyme journey, well, actually two of the things we see in the Lyme journey, first of all, is that the germs are now distributed through your entire body, right? And one of the reasons why so many doctors think that we as patients are suffering from mental illness rather than from a physiological illness is because the symptoms move from body part to body part. So the first time they come to see the doctor, they have a pain in one place, and then
Yeah.
they come to the doctor and they have a pain in another place, and they have pain in another place. And what's happening is these germs are being distributed through your whole body because your immune system is now tolerating these microbes, and they're now being distributed through your whole body, and then causing you to have a diverse set of symptoms, right?
Yep, exactly. And also, what happens here, and this is another big part, is that when your immune system is dormant like this and put to sleep, dormant viruses that are already in the host start reactivating.
Okay, so that's
So
the
you,
second piece of this, right?
yep.
So the second piece is that your immune system is managing a whole bunch of different germs, and then what happens is when you get Lyme disease, it knocks you out of homeostasis. You cannot
Yeah.
now manage all of these germs, and
Yeah.
now other germs that have otherwise been managed by your system, whether it could be Epstein-Barr,
Yeah.
it could be a number of other types of germs, are now no longer being managed by the immune system, and that's causing you to be sick as well, right?
Yeah, then it's a big part because it's like from head to toe, a lot of these dormant viruses reactivate, and LCM virus was kind of like the animal model of that, even though LCM can infect humans. It was kind of like he reactivated that virus with injections into the mouse's brain with a foreign protein, which kind of like the spike protein or the whatever, and
A surface
reactivated.
protein, right? It's a surface protein that's on the
Yeah.
bacteria that causes the immune system to be confused or defeated.
Yeah, and so Borrelia sheds these in large numbers, bleb, and these things called blebs, and overwhelm the immune system. And so that's like a big deal. And so you get those dormant viruses that reactivate. That's a big part of the illness. And then also opportunistic infections that also come in. So you get the mold toxicities and candida and things of that nature.
So now let's. I want to talk about one more piece, and then we're going to bring Amy back in to talk about her journey. Now, one of the most painful elements of a Lyme disease journey is that folks feel dependent. They become so sick, and they're so fatigued, and they're so overwhelmed physically, emotionally, and spiritually that in many cases they have to stop working and they have to become dependent on other family members
Yeah.
to take care of them financially, right?
Yeah.
So, can you talk about why that is a design element of this disease from Eric Traub's work,
Yeah.
and tie that into because that is at least in our experiences as folks who have interviewed over 400 chronic Lyme disease patients, one of the most painful part of this is becoming dependent, losing
Yes.
your independence, losing your ability to contribute financially, and having to become reliant economically on other family members.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there myself, so I know exactly how that is, and it's very demoralizing. And that was just another element of that strategy is to overwhelm the population. It also an economic weapon, you could call it. So economic weapons, weapons that debilitate people, so that people have to take care of other people, so that exactly like the situation you're seeing today, where people very so many people can't contribute to society because they have so many problems. And it's just when you look at that as a whole, when you look at the country, the state of health, I mean, that's exactly what you're seeing. You're seeing that rise in mental illness. You're seeing the rise in chronic disease. We're number one in mental illness, chronic disease, and very, and a lot of people have trouble contributing to society, in a healthy way, or, you know, a lot of, there's a lot of destructive ways people are contributing to society.
So, Adam, let me ask Amy now, now that she's heard all of these design features of a disease that she has suffered from for many years, that include, you know, so many of the triggers about Lyme disease, meaning it's triggering for folks in the community here. Hey, you don't look sick. We hear it, you know, we are triggered in this community when we take a test and we're told there's nothing wrong with you because you didn't test positive. And therefore, you're being gaslit by doctors and family members. That a design feature of this is to defeat your immune system and cause all kinds of other germs that you've been harboring and managing to take off and making you sick. And it's a design feature, Amy, that you would become economically dependent so that it would not only cripple you and your ability to contribute financially to your family, but so that it would also debilitate other family members who would then have to support you. What is your reaction to hearing all of these things that have been a part of your journey and now learning that it's that it was a design feature of these bioweaponeers?
Oh, that makes my blood boil so much. I mean, on top of having had Lyme, I was definitely diagnosed with ADHD as a child. We tend to naturally internalize a lot of our downfalls. So for me, having to ask my parents for help financially, it was really hard on me. I think Lyme disease left me with a bit of emotional trauma because not only having to go from doctor to doctor and having my childhood doctor that I had seen since I was an infant look at me and look at the labs and say, Amy, you know, you're a pretty girl. You come from a good family. Just not getting enough attention was like just glass shattering. And it made me start to question myself. And I'm very fortunate in a way that even as a child, I knew who I am and I knew what I wanted and I knew where I wanted to go. But having someone tell me something like that started to make me question my own perception of reality. I went to a huge journey of psychologists and therapists and antidepressants, and nothing ever worked. Nothing helped me.
So Adam, you know, you shared with us that you were put on a very addictive psychotropic medication, and of course it didn't work for you, right? And again, another part of this sort of overwhelming, economically overwhelming the system, right? So Adam, one of the things you did share with us early on in the podcast is that there's a difference between tactical weapons and strategic bioweapons, right? And you said that tactical bioweapons act quickly. And they kill quickly. And of course, they're easier to attach to the weaponeer. Whereas you define strategic weapons both here and in your book, is that they act slowly and they exhaust and tire. And you then earlier in our conversation today defined them as economic weapons, right? So it is at least clear to you and the you know the research that you've done, all of which is, by the way, borne out in dense footnotes in your very brilliantly written book. But it's your opinion, Adam, that the folks who are suffering from chronic Lyme disease are suffering from chronic Lyme disease as a result of being victims of this bioweapon, correct?
Yeah, it's bioterrorism that was unleashed on the country for Joseph Stalin, and the communists, but it was also with the help. See, it was kind of like interlaced into this biological simulant program where they're doing all these what are called simulation tests, where they thought they were, you know, working with a harmless microbe, but it turned out not to be so harmless, as Eric Traub was the one advising them and helping them run it, and they didn't know that he was a double agent at the time. So we were also kind of involved, but apparently a lot of the biodefense doing all of these tests didn't realize that we were being attacked many times over through this through these activities. So
So,
it's
but
war.
Adam, you believe that weaponized Lyme disease was released on the American mainland by the Russians, correct?
Yeah, it was it's war. Like, so my book is it kind of explains the whole war as well. So I go into Lyme disease, but I explain the background of how the biological warfare thing became such a big deal for countries that were getting involved in conflicts. And so that's one of the things you'll learn, and it's explained very well, documented very well. And so I do show that, yeah, there were all of these conferences they were having, like in 1953, for example, where the poultry industry was being rocked by all of these foreign animal diseases, and it was all about biological warfare. And they in that conference, they say they referred to fowl spirochetosis as a biological weapon, and that's the Borrelia anserina, the closest relative to Borrelia burgdorferi. And I made the case in my book that that's the strain that it was taken from that became Lyme disease. But they also noticed that in parallel to the poultry industry diseases, they were noting a parallel in the human population.
All right, so Adam, now let's tie this up for our folks. We're getting to the close to the 2 hour mark together, and I could talk another 10 hours with you
Yeah,
about
yeah.
this subject.
Sure.
But now let's tie it back together, right? Because look, Lyme disease is the Lyme disease rates are increasing, right? Millions of people are being infected with this disease in the U.S. every year, right?
Yeah.
This is another component to this, right? Because as time has changed between World War II and today, society has changed, right?
Yeah.
And society has changed in ways that are causing us to have a great deal more stress on our immune system, unrelated to the weaponized
Yeah.
microbes, right?
Yeah.
We live in a world where there are many petrochemical products that we're using, right? We are, so there are a lot of metals. Our food has been degraded. You and Amy were talking about that earlier. Amy has a great deal of expertise on the importance of food and how it has become degraded. And we also have all these social stresses, right? That we certainly didn't have at that time, especially women and the stresses that women are under. From all the social demands that are being put on women, right? So we sort of have this, these two trains sort of coming down the tracks, running into each other, where we have these, we have this much more viral strain of intentionally made more viral by these bioweaponeers. We have a lot more stresses in our society on our immune system, and now we have now millions of people every year suffering from this chronic disease. So Adam, let's talk about what we recommend to folks in order to be able to manage this disease and overcome this disease, right? Because it's really all about the immune system, right?
Yeah.
What Eric Traub was doing was creating a disease that was stealth. From the standpoint of how you ultimately contracted the disease, and stealth from the standpoint of the way that you would diagnose the disease. And he was doing this all with the idea that he was going to try to create an immune tolerance, right?
Yep.
So if we were going to now identify what we should be doing to make it more likely that we would not contract this disease, and even more importantly, make it more likely that we could recover from the disease, we have to focus on the immune system, right?
Yeah, and I would say that a big part of that too is finding as little stress as you can, because the stress actually makes the disease far worse. And that's a big deal. So, my journey was like a lot of digging within myself and also into the spiritual realm, because you're in this situation, you're kind of like trying to make sense of the world around you in the bigger picture at hand here, and what is the purpose of life? Why am I here? Why am I suffering? And things of that nature. And so I'm a very deep person as is, and I'm also an introvert, and I think about a lot of things on a deep level, and I do think about the big picture a lot. And I am a spiritual person. I don't think that all of this was an accident. I think everything about our universe is orderly and has a code, or developed through a certain code, a seed of life that was something created it, a divine intelligence, I would call it, a consciousness. And so in my situation, I kind of had to take a journey of making sense of the world around me, because also I know this stuff is really dark and makes, like she said, makes her blood boil. I don't do this to push fear. I only did this because I felt driven to do it by some force beyond myself. And I think we need to deal with some of these problems that are festering underneath. And this is one of them, and it's something that is very well documented in this book. I don't, other books have put the claim forward, but this book is the first book to really, go at it with extensive documentation. So,
So Adam, but let's build that what you were just talking
yeah.
about. I want to bring this in here, right? So what you're saying is, look, what happens is you begin to spiral down, right? You spiral
Yeah.
down physically, you spiral down emotionally, you spiral down spiritually. And what you need to do is recognize that the purpose and the design of this disease is to cause you to be stressed, because the stress that you suffer from spiritually will be immunosuppressive. The stress that you will suffer emotionally will be immunosuppressive. And the stress that you feel physically will be immunosuppressive. And you have to understand that you must put yourself in a position where you need to find purpose in this, so that you will not be spiritually stressed, right? You have to believe that you live, you use the Einstein quote, that you have to decide that you live in a friendly universe, not a hostile universe, that there's a purpose to this. And when you're looking for your purpose, that will reduce your spiritual stress, which will then reduce your emotional stress, which will then reduce your physical stress and put you in a position where you could start to take the steps that Amy was talking about: movement, rest, proper nutrition, do all of these immunosupportive things that you can't do if you're spiritually spinning out of control and you're emotionally spinning out of control, right? When you pull that all together, it allows you to stop the microbes from becoming immune tolerant, and it allows you to ultimately overcome and get back into homeostasis. In immune homeostasis.
Yeah, and finding something that drives you, if you can, finding, and looking into yourself for what you are here to do. If you have a purpose, like for me, even though I was like extremely sick, I felt driven from a force beyond myself, because I sought that out actively, and I was like, oh, okay, this book, and I did it. Even at my sickest, I still was driven to do it, and I did that.
But so Adam, let's tie this back now to the transformation, right? Because I have to tie up the transformation before Amy comes in and asks you the final question, right? You always had this interest in bioweapons. You were kind of this weird guy who would be in the library and he'd be interested in bioweapons, not knowing that that was your purpose, that you were brought here by intelligence, to ultimately have an experience that would tie you back to a place where you would write one of the most densely researched and footnoted Lyme disease books that I've ever read. And I've read more than 100 books on Lyme disease. I read almost all of the expert materials, right? And you, who is not a formally educated researcher, to tie this back, have written one of the most, as I argued, one of the most densely researched books, to the point where again, one of the leaders in the bioweapons research world described you in the introduction as the person who's likely to win the Nobel Peace Prize, the person in medicine, despite not being a medical doctor, right? So I mean, that is the beauty of your story, and I think the beauty of your book, that it was that you were put in a position, despite not, by any objective observation about your education or your training or your degrees or your experience, to have had the ability to write this book.
And it kind of like you see the world and the dark stuff in it, and you say, okay, there's good and evil operating on this planet. I want to be on the side of good. What can I do to help my fellow humans? And that's another thing you want to look at when you try to find your purpose, is we're also here to help others too. So
Right.
we all have a part to play, and this was just my part to play, and for each person it's different. So this transformation happens in a unique way for each person.
So, I mean, the spirit of helping others and recognizing that we as humans are put on this earth to help other people. You've done a wonderful job as being my co-host. Why don't you give us first your reaction to everything that you've learned now from Adam's experiences and his research? And then after you make your observations, maybe you can ask them the final question.
Actually, I'm kind of a World War II nerd as well, just in a different aspect. I like to research the in important roles that women played during World War II. It's super interesting, like the Wasps, and then we got Great Britain's Wrens and the Land Girl Army and the Rosies. Like, I love that stuff. But I really, really enjoyed your story and your book. I didn't get to read the book. I read a bunch. I actually listened to a bunch of podcasts because I've been doing my master's, so I'm already with the in-depth reading. But it's just so incredible. You're kind of a rad dude. You had me at metal. But I think coming back to my journey too, it's like, I feel the moments in life that bring us to our knees are re really define us as human beings, because we can choose to stay down as a victim, or we can get up and keep fighting. And I think you really got up and you kept fighting, and you it's just I will read your book eventually. I just got to get through my master's.
I also have like a YouTube channel where I kind of go over like step by step many different elements of the book.
I'll have to find that.
It's
But the question I really want to ask you is, if a loved one came to you with a tick biting them on their leg or anywhere, what would you recommend that they could do so that they didn't have to face the suffering caused by chronic Lyme disease? What should they do?
Yeah, I guess I would save that tick. That would be important. That would be an important thing, to save that tick. There are places that you can send it to see what it has. And as far as how to prevent it, there's different methods. Some people could go to the doctor and get a course of antibiotics. I'm not sure. I would also probably recommend high dose vitamin C, maybe. It's hard to say because it's
Come on, Adam. I'm going to beat you up a little bit here. Your
okay.
entire book is about immune tolerance, right? So if you get bitten by a tick, as Amy had asked you, and you want to make sure that you do not become chronically ill, you have to engage in immunosupportive behaviors, right, Adam?
That would be a fair assessment, of course.
All right, it's certainly based on your
Yeah,
research.
so I
So
mean, like I said, high dose vitamin C. There could be
that's,
other things as well.
like, how about like rest? How about being really careful with your nutrition? For your diet.
Your stress levels as well.
I mean, there are a number of different. You have to make sure that you're not smoking. You have to make sure that you're engaging in all of these healthy behaviors so that you're supporting your immune system while it's going through this battle with these bioengineered microbes, right? Right, because Amy gave you the softball, Adam, and you didn't hit it, but I had to come in and help you out there and make sure that we recognize that the immune system will either win or lose the day here. And if we're going to follow up with Amy's question, what you want to do is you want to support your immune system before it becomes overwhelmed and stop yourself from being in the position where you now have to rebuild your immune system by making sure that you're spiritually, emotionally, and physically healthy, and you're going through this process healthy way. So again, I can't thank you enough, Adam, for taking time out of your really busy schedule. I know you're one of the guys who's on the podcast loop. Everybody's getting online to interview you, and so thank you for taking time out to join me and Amy. And Amy, thank you so much for revisiting us here at Tick Boot Camp. You're a wonderful human, Amy, and we loved you in episode 53, I think it was, and we're really glad to have you rejoin us here here in our 400th plus episode, and interviewing Adam in this in this really, really powerful way. So thank the two of you for joining us here at Tick Boot Camp.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. This was fun.
Bye, Amy.
Bye.